Audio Drama Production Podcast.
I'm Matt Boudreau.
And I'm Austin Beach. You're listening to the Audio Drama Production Podcast.
This week on the Audio Drama Production Podcast, Scooter interviews Ellie Maitland of Wildclaw Theater about writing for sound.
All right, so today with me I have Ellie Maitland. She's from Wildclaw Theater, and she's here to talk to us about the nuances of dealing with sound effects and other foley in a script.
Hi there. Hi, Ellie. Good to be on the show. Thanks for having me, Scooter. And like Scooter said, I'm Wildclaw Theater in Chicago, and I also work with a couple other theaters here in Chicago that consistently produce audio dramas on stage, including I've performed with Heartlife NFP's Our Fair City, both as a voice actor and an onstage Foley performer. I will be performing in their upcoming Unwell. And I also work with Locked Into Vacancy Entertainment, which curates a monthly show out of Stage 773 featuring comedy serials that they then perform, that they then produce online through their podcasting network.
Awesome. That sounds great.
Yeah, thanks. And Wildclaw may be best recognized to audio dramatists for their annual International Short Horror Audio Drama Festival, Deathscribe. We've been doing that for 11 years now. We'll start taking submissions for year 12, probably in May of this year. And that is when we'll be combing the globe for horror shorts that will be performed on stage in front of a live audience, backed by a full band and a team of Foley artists creating all the sound effects live.
Yeah, if you've never checked out their stuff for that, it's fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's great.
That was actually my introduction to audio drama and to sound design work. And I've learned a lot through the years. I always insist on being one of the teams that read everything that gets submitted. So that means that I get to read somewhere between 1 and 200 scripts every year. And I really love what I learn about how people are interpreting the assignment, because the idea of writing something explicitly for horror audiences and explicitly for radio audiences still opens up a very wide interpretation for what that means. We learn every year what people think is scary and also what stories they think earn the medium of radio plays. And that's really, really cool to me.
I guess, how do you differentiate a okay versus an amazing script?
That's a good question. And it depends on a year-to-year basis about whether or not we think things are relevant to a contemporary audience, whether or not it's something that's going to be universal, because every year's submissions also are kind of a time capsule of what is going on that people are reacting to and is frightening to them that they can then deconstruct with an audience or their community. And when people ask what the best stories are, that's not necessarily even what makes it into the festival every year. We're looking for what are the best five exemplars of that, of the different subgenres of horror. A lot of what I'm looking for are different opportunities for voice actors. So that means youthful stories or stories for the elderly. It also means that we're looking for diversity and representation as far as POC or non-binary representation. There's been a lot of accountability exploration in the Chicago scene in the past couple of years, and I'm really glad that that has been part of the conversation that we're trying to commit to. But when it comes to the radio side of this problem, I think a lot of it to me is earning the medium of radio play. One of the things that I find a little disappointing when I see some other radio properties out there is sometimes it just feels like a bunch of talking heads, which, yeah, obviously that's going to be what the vocal characters are. But a lot of it to me is making sure that there is a compelling setting for these stories, and making sure that the sound acts as an additional character in the story that the voice actors or voice characters are reacting to and have their own specific relationships to. And so that means when something happens that affects them physically, they can have very clear reactions to it that moves them forward as characters and gives them more in their arc. So that can be either things in the world around them or things in the world that they are manipulating. And that's also something that informs how I'm choreographing things as a Foley performer and designer. When they're in an environment that's like snowy and windy, that gives the actors something else that they can be acting against. So that could inform how they're delivering their lines, if they're shivering from the cold, or if they get a raindrop in their eye, or if they're walking through the forest and someone snaps a twig and it startles them. That can be heightening tension. So there are a lot of fun things that even may not necessarily be prescribed in the sounds in the script. But when you know that you've got something beyond just a bare room that people are interacting in, then that can open up a lot of different opportunities for the sound designer to build in these opportunities for the actors as they're building their character and you're building the world for that character to play in.
From what I'm hearing, it sounds like some of the key things are you want the sound effects and the audio cues to be more integrated as almost a character in the script itself, right?
Oh yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. And I think also for that person that's reading your script the first time, one of the better things you can do is be as specific as possible about what those sounds are meant to accomplish. An example I would give is if something squishy is happening, we want to know exactly what it is that's providing that squishy sound. So let's say from a not so hypothetical example, one of my favorite playwrights that we've produced a number of times in Describe would be Joe Zettelmeyer. And he's got this piece called The Monroe County Pumpkin Queen that we performed back in, I think, 2013, maybe? It was also part of a Best of Describe program that we performed at Steppenwolf and at the Arsht Center back in 2016. And this is a body horror piece. So there is this mad scientist who is turning people into gourds. So that is what the Pumpkin Queen actually is in this story. I know it sounds like a beauty pageant. Maybe it's more than that. And at one point, the experiment fails in the most graphic, visceral way possible. And so the audience could recognize what's going on from that when they hear it. But when you're reading it for the first time, I think it was pretty crucial that rather than just hearing sound effects, a wet explosion, you get to read sound effect. The Pumpkin Queen explodes wetly, because then that gives you all the specificity you know about where the story is going. And that gives you opportunities for the actor that's playing the Pumpkin Queen to be part of the sound of that explosion. And it tells you to explore different kinds of wetness in your design. And also not just the actual explosion, but the aftermath and the way that the surviving characters are reacting to it. Because that can be a lot of fun, gross reaction sounds from everybody in the room.
So is there such a thing as too much detailed notes for the sound notes?
The thing that happens when you're writing a story for any collaborative art form, you have to have permission for the people that are going to be collaborating with you to make their own decisions and put their own interpretations on it. So the more specific and clutched the sound effects feel like, or in any part of the writing process, the more control you put on any specific part of the story, the more you're at risk for being disappointed when it gets into the hands of other collaborators, because storytelling in this medium, in the performative arts, is going to be very interactive. You're going to have to make room for other people to have their own interpretation of the story and put their own spin on it, which hopefully will open up the world even more for you and make it more exciting and make better choices for you in the future. Because if you insist on everyone doing it exactly the way that you have it written, and that's not me saying that I want to be rewriting lines or anything like that, but maybe the delivery of a line won't be exactly how you hear it in your head, but maybe it'll be even better. Or if you open up casting, like that's another one of the things that we're looking at right now, as we're recognizing that people don't just come in straight white cis packages. We should be able to open up the way that we're casting things and let that be another way of celebrating the human experience and human condition.
See, I'm curious, because we've been trying to redesign on Storytime how we shape our scripts as we're writing them.
Oh, yeah?
Like, especially when it comes to sound effects. Because we've had a lot of back and forth with our audio engineers about them being either confused or talking about how that specific sound effect is pretty much near impossible with the way it's described.
Aw.
And not necessarily impossible, but kind of infeasible with the way it was described. And then we found out that the writer actually intended something entirely different. They just didn't describe it in a way that made sense to people that were not them.
I think that's why it's good to have an opportunity for dialogue with the original creator and with the people that are interpreting their work. And sometimes, you know, not to be bad cop, but there are just some things that don't necessarily effectively translate to audio drama the same way they would in a visual medium. As far as like tracking certain sounds for the sake of continuity, for building an experience with the audience so they know exactly what's going on. Sometimes you have to rely on a little bit more dialogue for explicating what's going on in the character's environment. And I think that takes a really, really skilled hand. So it doesn't just sound like they're spoon feeding and narrating everything that's going on. But it's like any other kind of exposition and storytelling. There are heavy-handed ways of doing things, and then there are more economic ways of doing things that help tell the story and take advantage of the conventions that we all understand as audience members from being submerged in story for the past several decades. Like, the first thing we all do is learn story because we're being read to, or we're watching children's programming, or we're hearing how our friends and family interact with each other. Everything has a story attached. You don't just walk into a store with your Apple phone and say, I need a new one. You say, so this one was, I was out on the lake with some friends and our dog fell into the lake and I had to reach in and grab the dog and my iPhone fell out of my pocket. And I tried that thing where you put it in a bucket of rice and it didn't work. So now I need a new one. Because everyone feels like they have to share part of their experience in order to get what it is that they're looking for as the next part of their experience. Everyone thinks in story. Everyone interacts in story. It's a form of currency for us. And so we can be using that to our advantage when we're writing for an audience. Writing to the smartest person in the room is a very important part of any sort of storytelling.
What does that mean?
Trust people to understand where the story is going, rather than feeling like you have to over-explain things in dialogue. You can be focus grouping things with your friends and with your artistic community before you release things large scale. Like, that's one of the reasons why we rely so heavily on previews in the Chicago theater scene, or why it's great to give a script to a friend and say, hey, can you look over this and let me know if you have any questions or if anything's not too clear. But overall, people want to understand what stories you're telling. And I think that we can be trusting people more than we typically do.
I feel like that's very similar to, especially in the 90s and early 2000s movies, American movies especially, that we were getting to the point of over-explaining everything and expecting everybody to be kind of lowest common denominator.
Oh, very much so. And you can be taking advantage of conventions. There are certain things sonically that we really recognize that we've been trained on in cartoons, TV, and movies, and can use in our understanding of audio drama pretty easily. We know what it sounds like when someone is pouring a cup of coffee. We know what it sounds like when someone is walking across a room. So those are things that we can be taking more advantage of as, or not spoon feeding to an audience so much, that can inform the way that we're using the dialogue that are causing or coming from those sound effects. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
And then there are things that are going to be a little bit more specific to the story that you've built to that point, or might earn a little bit more specificity in their explication in dialogue from an audience. Like, they might not know what your space creatures sound like. So if you're in a room full of them, there might be a reason to have some your characters talking about what it's like for them to be there.
How much of this do you feel like is cultural?
I think a lot of it is. And I think a lot of it is generational, too. I feel like people in their 30s through 60s probably have a good grasp on very uniform narrative conventions and vocabulary, because there was a finite amount of storytelling going on in our experience when we were growing up. there weren't so many TV channels and there wasn't all the stuff streaming on the internet. Nowadays, there are so many things not only that people are generating originally nowadays, but people have the luxury of pretty much seeing anything from the past 80 years of cinema at the drop of a hat. They can click on anything and they can be making that part of the conventions that they're teaching and reteaching to themselves and to their children. So I'm really curious about what that's going to do to narrative conventions that we all have a shared vocabulary for another 10 or 20 years from now, when those people that were raised in this era start their own creations and get more widespread exposure and experience as storytellers.
What are some of the things that you would like to see happen more often in scripts? Either like an element of the story that would be more interesting to do with sound effects, or something that you think people should avoid?
I like it when people play with conventions in a way, like I like comedy rule of threes when it comes to how things are being established. And I think that there's a lot of cross-pollination between comedic writing and horror writing, because so much of it is about like sustains and then releases of tension. So I like when a story surprises me. I like when there's a twist that I don't see coming, but it is still well-earned. I like something that makes me want to say, wait, I got to read that again, like immediately, so I can then understand and further appreciate the ways that it took me down one path and then took me down another. When it comes to things I don't want to see again, part of it is just like having read so many stories that are in this medium over the past 8 years that I've been a company member with Wildclaw. I'm really, really lucky for this to have been a facet of my education in this medium. It's easy for me to look at something and go, oh, this again. But sometimes you just want good takes. Sometimes something doesn't need to be revolutionary, but the more familiar it is, it means the better the execution of it has to be in order to make the audience excited and satisfied. I also don't like torture porn, but that's just me.
Yeah, no, I got you. I'm really not a big fan of torture porn.
I feel like torture porn for me is a lot more emphasis on the gore.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Which is interesting too. One of the conventions I realized that we've been trained in with cinema that doesn't translate quite the same way to audio drama, at least for horror, is so often in film and TV, and I'm not sure if this is like a holdover from like the Hays Code or the movie rating system, whatever it is like technically called now. But my first example would be Misery. Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen the movie Misery with James Caan and Kathy Bates. But there's a sequence where Kathy Bates' character is hobbling James Caan. She takes a sledgehammer to his feet, so he can't run away again. And in that, like, we see her prepare him for this experience, and then we see her raise the sledgehammer, and then the camera pans away. So we're just looking at the wall while we're hearing the execution of this hobbling, and we hear James Caan crying in agony while Kathy Bates is swinging the sledgehammer and those crucial impact sounds. But because we're panning away, the audience is, for one, left up to their imagination of what it is they're missing, but also has a suggestion of something else to be thinking about. They can focus on the wall if they want to. With audio drama, if you're going for those really visceral sounds, we don't have generally the luxury of a jump cut or a pan away to suggest something else they could be thinking about. It is all just about the immediate action of that gory or visceral or really traumatic experience.
Actually, that's something we run into every so often, where something will happen in the show and it needs to have a very appropriate sound effect. But if we go too far with that sound effect, it's almost jarring because it's pulling away from the rest of the story.
Yeah.
And the people have to recover almost.
I can totally see that.
All right. So what's the sound effect that you were the most excited to do when you read about it and you realized that you were going to be having to craft it?
Well, gee, for someone who just said that she doesn't like torture porn, we did a piece this past year that I was super excited about that had a character getting fully submerged in the ocean. And so building the soundscape of starting out above water with the sound of the waves crashing and the seagulls crying, and then having him dive all the way underneath. So it was a more sustained splash, and then trying to execute the sounds of rushing water around him as he's going deeper and deeper and beginning to lose consciousness was really, really exciting exercise for the Foley team. And so it involved an ocean drum, of course. It involved a really happy accident for me this year. I was just walking around Party City squeezing things, because that's a lot of what you do when you're trying to find stuff just for either specific opportunities for sound, or if you're looking for something that, like, oh, I might have a reason to use this someday. And I found these plastic squeak toys shaped like unicorns that, if you squeezed their flanks in the exact right place, gave you a good seagull cry. So I got a couple of those. So one of them could just be a single seagull flying overhead, or you could have a flock if you were squeezing the two of them in tandem rapidly. So that was a lot of fun to get to experiment with this year. For the splashing and descent into the deep, that was, of course, a controlled splash, which we used a bucket of water and a toilet plunger for. Quick tip for anyone that's ever doing any of this in-house or for the first time, you're going to get a better splash and a more controllable splash when you're pulling a plunger out of water, because the point is to be displacing water, and you'll have more control when you're pulling something out rather than putting something in. And when you're working with microphones and other sound equipment, you want to make sure that you have, you're in charge of the water rather than the other way around. We also used a rain stick, a really big rain stick with a contact mic on it, and pulled out a lot of the high end. So it was a really low rushing sound that was a constant until everything was taken over by our band leader, Joe Griffin, who Scooter knows. We've all met together. He's lovely, and he's a really talented musician and sound designer in the Chicago scene as well. Was playing a detuned guitar string to be this kind of like underwater wobbly kind of sound. And once we had established that the character was underwater, fully submerged and in this kind of weird sonic environment, we also had bubbling sound, so straw in water for his oxygen escaping. And also we were using a chamois pulled in rhythm under a microphone to be the sound of his heartbeat, which raced as he started panicking and then started slowing and finally came to a stop as he had drowned.
That's good.
It was a lot of fun. I think it went pretty well.
It sounds like at some point you guys need to have a sound effects party where you just bring all your equipment and you just start mixing up new scenes live, kind of.
Right. Oh, you know, that's actually a big part of the design process. I call them noise parties. When we have gotten all the scripts that we're going to be working on for the year and we have a lot of theories for how things are going to go, noise party is a combination of teaching choreography and also exploring and experimenting. If we have like that one sound we've never done before, but we've done some research, because you can look at a lot of things online as far as current conventions in sound design and Foley executions that have been used in the past 80, 90 years, actually more than the history of cinema, because a lot of the conventions that we use in sound design are held over still from vaudeville and commedia even before that. Quick side note, one of the earliest and really exciting examples of sound design that a lot of people don't recognize nowadays, there are a couple of theaters in London that still have what they call thunder runs, which are gutter systems that are built and suspended above the audience for them to roll wooden cannonballs through to create the rumbling sound of a thunderstorm. So a lot of these ideas have been in practice for centuries, if not millennia.
I really like that idea. I think movie theaters need to do something like that, where it's just small elements of live Foley.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I think that, one of the reasons why I stick with theater is because of the risk involved and knowing that things can go wrong. I feel like the audience needs to want the story to work in a way that doesn't necessarily have to happen in cinema. And so there is a different opportunity for emotional investment from the audience, and it makes them a more active member of the community that you're building every time there's a show being performed.
So the audience is kind of part of the experience.
Oh, yeah. There's a theater company that I've worked with in Chicago. I'm a company member still, but it's been a while since I've worked with them, called The House. And the reason why they are called that is because the full theater including the house, which is where the audience sits, is necessary to make all of their stories, all of their shows work. Having an audience that is complicit and engaged in the stories they are telling is the final element that makes theater what it is.
Here's your vocal exercise for the week.
Here's a vocal exercise to work on those articulators. I'm going to start out slow and we're going to get progressively harder. Repeat after me. Ba-ba-ba. Da-da-da. La-la-la. Ga-ga-ga. So that's B-D-L-G. Ba-ba-ba, da-da-da, la-la-la, ga-ga-ga. All right, let's begin the exercise. Ba-ba-ba. Da-da-da. La-la-la. Ga-ga-ga. Ba-ba-ba. Da-da-da. La-la-la. Ga-ga-ga. Ba-ba-ba, da-da-da. La-la-la, ga-ga-ga. Ba-ba-ba, da-da-da. La-la-la, ga-ga-ga. Ba-ba-ba, da-da-da, la-la-la, ga-ga-ga. Ba-ba-ba, da-da-da, la-la-la, ga-ga-ga. Ga-ga-ga, la-la-la, da-da-da, ba-ba-ba. Ga-ga-ga, la-la-la, da-da-da, ba-ba-ba. Ba-ba-ba, da-da-da, la-la-la, ga-ga-ga. 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 Ga-ga-ga, la-la-la, da-da-da, ba-ba-ba. Did you keep up? If not, keep trying. All right, we'll see you next time with another exercise.
In case you weren't aware, the Audio Drama Production Podcast has a Patreon page. If you'd like to contribute to the show, you can donate at patreon.com/ADPP.
Thank you for listening to the Audio Drama Production Podcast.
Special thanks to Tanya Maloyevich and Scooter Mann.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.